Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, offering a variety of steak, salmon, and chicken breasts for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
David Archuleta became famous on the reality singing competition show American Idol. This was in the early years, before these kinds of shows were everywhere. I'm not sure it does it anymore, but back then, it could make you a star. He had an incredible voice, but he also had a great storyline, a sheltered, soft-spoken Mormon kid from Utah. What people didn't know then was his turbulent family life, including a domineering father, and the deep conflict he was hiding, struggling with his sexuality and praying to be changed. Archuleta has written a memoir where he works through all of this, how he checked out of his singing career to serve a mission and defend his faith, how he struggled to separate himself from what he once believed would save him. The book is really more about him taking control of his life than just coming out, though he did come out publicly in June of 2021 in an Instagram post. He says he wrote the book to share his story, something he realized after a moment of clarity at the Salt Lake airport during his Christmas tour.
Just going to Salt Lake, it felt weird because I felt like I was suddenly this traitor. You know, once I was this hometown hero, and I was like, I'm still going to church, but I felt such mixed feelings about it because I had come out as queer, and I felt like it was an answer to my prayers. And who I thought God was had shifted. It was like the first time I was experiencing that God loved me. But I felt like a lot of people around me in my community and who had been watching me didn't want to accept that. So I'm there kind of just like keeping my head down. I have a hat on because I'm like, I don't want to be seen. And that's when this guy approaches me and he just starts talking. He's so excited to see me. And he's like, I can't believe you're here.
It's amazing how half a lifetime in the spotlight can make certain interactions so normal, no matter your mood or the fact that you've been dealing with the biggest change in your life. But I lit up into meet and greet mode and said, hello. I just wanted to say I really admire what you do. I'm involved in music, too, in my church choir. His energy shifted suddenly and he blurted out, how did you do it? Puzzled, I asked, how did I do what? How did you come out? His eyes darkened. I was surprised by the question, and yet somehow knew it was coming. How did I come out? Before I could fumble for a concise answer, he said, I'm on my way to see my bishop right now. I seriously don't know what to do or say. I was just thinking, other people have done this. David Archuleta did it. And then I saw you. I can't believe you're here.
I recognize that look in someone's eyes when you're starting to feel desperate and in despair and hopeless. And that's when I asked him, have you been having suicidal thoughts?
I have been for the last month. I listened intently as he shared that his bishop, a church leader, had been accepting and loving to him. But he couldn't accept himself for having same-sex attraction. Mormons preferred the phrase same-sex attraction instead of gay. To those of us raised in conservative religions, a person who was gay or part of the alphabet people was a pervert with no sexual control. But same-sex attraction was something that a righteous person could overcome. I said a little prayer in my heart, hoping to find the words that would keep this man hopeful.
How do you help someone who's still stuck in that thought pattern that this is my safe place? I need to do everything I can to stay here because if I leave it, I'm in danger. How do I help explain it to him in a way that he will still accept it? Because if I threaten his beliefs, he may not want to hear what I have to say because I've been there and a lot of others have been there and are there.
What could I say that would give him hope and keep him alive? I offered to him all I had, which was simply what I was learning as I progressed on my own journey, one day at a time. I think he felt better when we parted, but I didn't have all the answers for him. I was very much still figuring things out for myself. Though our conversation helped clarify a few things for me too.
I think I saw in him and the way he was like hungry for anything I had to say to him that I was still an example for a lot of people in this position. And I saw that I still had some influence still after coming out, especially for people who were queer and struggling with the queer experience and identity and wondering if they could still belong if they came to terms with accepting their queer identity and living as a queer person. So if I still have power and influence, then I want to make sure I use it.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. David Archuleta's memoir is called Devout. He's joining us to talk about it. And we started the conversation with the difference between telling your story in music and telling it in a book, which he has described as a new way of writing lyrics to the songs of your life.
I would say music has its pros and its cons because you only get like anywhere from like generally 2 to 4 minutes.
Yeah.
To say your message.
Couple of lines.
Yeah. And it's hard to be concise and to the point to summarize, especially for me. So in a book, I was able to go for, you know, hundreds of pages.
Yeah.
And really dive into my story and go into detail and elaborate. It's like if something I would say in a song is like, well, what do you mean? I could elaborate in the book. It just like let people enter into a world in another way, which was really fun. It was daunting at first.
Yeah.
It was intimidating. I was like, I don't think I can do this. Let me just get a ghostwriter. But I talked to a couple of other writer friends and through their encouragement, I was like, you know what? No, it may suck right now, but it's going to feel so fulfilling once I get to the end of this. And it has been. But man, it sucked. To start it, I was like, I almost threw the towel. I'm like, I cannot do this. I don't know where to take this. And luckily, I had an amazing collaborator, Valerie Frankel, who helped me to organize it. And to when I would tell my story, she could add a little bit here and there. But it was my story.
Yeah.
It was, I wrote it all. I said too much. She helped me to cut it down. But yeah, it feels so satisfying now.
Here's something you write at the beginning of the book. You write, "My life was always about music even before I was born." Let's talk about that. You were born into a family that had a history and a passion for music in your blood. How do you think about that?
Yeah. I mean, I would say it is genetic because, I mean, I don't know where it came from.
Yeah.
And I know my parents both were into music. Since before I was born, my mom was a performer and dancer, my dad, trumpet player and jazz musician, and even my grandparents. My mom's mom was a songwriter, singer, and my dad's mom was a singer, performer in theater here locally in Utah, and she was quite well known in the theater world.
Did you think, oh, music's everywhere?
Yeah.
So that this is for me, or did you think about it early on?
No.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't think about it. It's kind of like, it's just like a feeling, like when you're hungry, it's okay, like, let me find something to eat.
Mm.
Kind of an emotion, or it's like, I'm cold, let me find a blanket. It's just, it felt reactive. I wasn't really thinking of it. So I like listened to this, you know, the Les Miserables.
Well, that's a great story. So you're right about that moment. Your family's moving from Florida here to Utah. Your folks are unpacking all the stuff. And your father sits down, pops in this VHS tape, and it has the PBS Les Mis anniversary concert or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that moment, if you would. You talk about being hooked. You talk about being fixated. It kind of seemed like a sort of an epiphany in some way.
Yeah. it felt like a revelation, in a sense. Just, this makes sense. And it didn't exist before, but suddenly it's like, there it is. It just felt so natural and effortless to transition into this passion for and a love for music. And my parents were fascinated by my fascination with the musical. So my mom immediately put in front of me Selena Quintanilla and had me learn Como la Flor by her. And then my dad followed up with Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and Evita from Andrew Lloyd Webber's catalog. I was just absorbing it all. I just felt like, ooh, give me more. Like, I want to take in these melodies. And it's like, you hear songs around you, but it was just like something clicked when I watched someone perform it and felt like, oh, I can embody that myself and experience it in this new way rather than just listening to something on the radio.
But when did you know that it was, so you love it, you're fixated on it, but when did you know you have a voice, like a great voice? Like, when did you discover that part? Did that come right away, or like, how did that work?
I didn't look at it as a great voice. Huh. It just felt like this. I just loved the feeling I got in performing. And I didn't look at it as, ooh, like, I didn't think of, how do I sound in comparison to other performers?
It was more natural than that.
It was just embodying the same feelings and elements of music as these other performers were doing, as I watched on in this VHS tape of Les Miserables. So when my parents started recording me, and my dad. Yeah. My dad would record and be like, David, look at you performing. I was like, oh my God. It freaked me out. I was like, what are you doing? Why are you showing that to me? I was repulsed by it. I didn't like it. I could hear my mistakes. I didn't like the tone of my voice. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's how I sound? Oh my goodness. And I talk about in my book how I didn't really like myself.
Yeah.
But also my dad had this obsession with, he was so, it was like he was enamored with my singing and
fixated on your fixation. You said fixated on your fixation of the music.
He was, and he was hyper fixated on it. So he was, I think I also was turned off by that. Cause it was like, oh, I don't have my own space here. It was like my little escape. And now I'd involve my dad into it. And not only that, like my dad started kind of taking over it. And it was becoming his thing. And I didn't like that. So it kind of, you know, as I got older, I didn't like it nearly as much as when I was a little kid.
This becomes such a theme in the book, doesn't it? This idea of him sort of having his dreams for himself that he just imposes on you, and you trying to get away from it, trying to have your own kind of genuine sense of who you are and being authentic to yourself. It seems like the theme of the book, or certainly one of them, do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like it is the main theme, even though it starts with the introduction of someone asking me, how did I come out? But I feel like in order for me to come out, I had to be willing to stop giving my life to other people. And that started with my dad. You know, that was the first time I started giving myself up to please the authority figure in my life, which at that time was my dad.
You say that in the book that the two hardest things for you to write about were the experience on Idol, which we'll talk a little bit about, but then also your father, those two things, Idol and your father. Mm-hmm. And the way you've talked about it is that in the book, you'd sort of already, at least emotionally, processed your sexuality, but you hadn't processed that dynamic with your father yet. And it seems like the Idol part, processing that, was connected to your relationship with your father, I suppose. Is that why those were the two most difficult things to write about?
They're definitely connected.
Yeah.
There's definitely a relationship within those two things, while also being two separate challenges.
Sure.
Up until that point, the way I'd learned how to survive and just get through life was to hide. and to minimize myself. It helped me to be more agreeable with my dad, to just go along with him, to not have any issues with him. And it also helped me to hide from any attempt of being found out for what I really was, whatever that may be. But I guess it was just being gay or being queer, which I was very afraid of. And so I was like, well, if I minimize myself, no one will notice because I don't know what else to do. I don't know how to get rid of this. So if I hide, okay, people will leave me alone and maybe it won't be an issue for other people. And then I get onto American Idol and I can't, that tactic no longer works. I can't just.
You can't hide.
Yeah. I can't minimize myself. And I tried to. Huh. And I think people found that endearing because I was so shy and they would see how I just like, felt so uncomfortable there. I didn't know how to make the most of that moment of being watched by millions of people and being named as one of the front runners of the show. And I was like, well, what am I doing to gain all this attention? Like, I kind of just thought, you know, if I do what I'm told, whether that's by my dad or by the producers or by America, that is everyone watching, then I could go about and do my own thing. Because that's how it worked with my dad. If I did what I was told, gave him what he wanted, then he'd be like, okay, you passed, you did what I wanted, we got the results.
Yep.
You can carry on and go outside and play with your siblings or play with your friends, go rollerblade. That didn't work on American Idol. And even though I was 17 years old by the time of like the live competition part of it, I was a really young 17-year-old, yeah. Even though I was like close to being 18 and could live on my own technically, I felt like I had this mentality of like a 12-year-old or 11-year-old. And I think that's how my dad had conditioned me to be. I don't think he meant to consciously do that, but that's just what happened.
Yeah.
And so there I was, doing what I was told, and it was getting me more attention. And really, in the end, I mean, that's kind of what happened with my dad as well. The more I did what he wanted, the more he obsessed over it. And so I felt like it was like the more America and the producers were upset, and my dad were all obsessing over me on live television in front of everybody. And I had no control. I felt such a loss that the way I controlled the scenario and my environment was to hide and be quiet. And just be in the background. Even when I hung out with like friends or like in church groups, I was always in the background. Yeah. And I had no option. I felt powerless on American Idol, which was really difficult for me because I felt like if I had control, I would have control over my feelings and how people perceived me. And I didn't know it at the time, but I felt like that's how I could have a control over my sexuality as well.
Hmm. Can I back up a few years before we get to Idol, to a moment in your life that you described that I think helps explain sort of where you ended up in terms of wanting to hide? There's this song that you wrote a few years ago now on the expanded version of your album, Therapy Sessions. It's called 9 Years Old. And you've talked about this album. And I was looking at the lyrics and what you're expressing here because it was this 9-year-old you. This is the hinge point or a hinge point in your life. And you write about being these are the lyrics, a little boy by the trampoline, neighbor dog barking at me, solo singing in my backyard. Nothing to worry about. You're all alone. And you write about how you can be yourself. I can be myself. That is how I felt when I was 9 years old. Didn't sing because you were watching. Didn't need my song to be sold. Will you talk about that song and what happens at 9 years old? Because before there was no, didn't seem to be anyway, financial incentive, no pressure, no real pressure yet. Can you talk about this moment in your life?
Yeah, I'm impressed you found that song because it's like a deep cut, even for, you know, usually people just know Crush and then that's even deeper for my fans. But it was just, I wanted to capture that time where I wasn't afraid of anything. There was nothing to worry about. I didn't have any expectations placed on me. And I was just able to enjoy the craft and the art of singing just for what I originally fell in love with it for. I wrote that song before I had processed all of this in the book. You know, that I wrote that song before I came out. And before my family had even addressed any of the issues that happened with all these accusations made, these false accusations that were terribly made, wrongfully made against my dad.
Yeah. This was when you were nine. And this is you mentioned going through this crisis that changes your lives, your family's lives, and their relationships.
Yeah. And this is all, and none of us had talked about this really up until I started writing the book.
Wow.
And when I started talking about it, I realized how much that affected everybody, especially my siblings. But when I was nine, it's like when I started having to learn that the world was dangerous and scary, and I learned to be afraid of my dad. I wasn't afraid of him before that. I was basically conditioned, really manipulated to be afraid of my dad for the personal agendas that someone else had.
A close family friend. You're not any more specific than that, and we don't need to be, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This close family friend that I was staying with, and you know, looking back, I was very scared. I didn't know how to process the information that they were giving to me.
Yeah.
They basically just told me that my dad needed to be sent away. I mean, their goal was to get my dad into prison.
Yeah.
But for what reasons? I didn't understand. I found out later on that it was just my dad's can be a jerk and he can say things that are really offensive to people. But that's not enough of justification to put him into prison because you were offended by things that he said to you. It doesn't justify trying to take a father away from his children and to villainize and make them afraid of him when there wasn't any reason to. Mm. You know, looking back, I learned that adults are willing to take advantage of innocent kids and not really care about the effects that it may have on them.
David Archuleta, his book is called Devout, Losing My Faith to Find Myself. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, offering a variety of steak, salmon, and chicken breasts for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the singer David Archuleta, who, as you may know, rocketed to fame on the reality singing competition show American Idol. Archuleta has a memoir where he explores his struggle to reconcile his sexuality with his faith as a devoted Latter-day Saint. But the book is really about control, about handing over your will to your parents, your church, even your audience. It's called Devout. So this is interesting. You say in the book that you had blocked out a lot of the experience of American Idol and that apparently a lot of other people had too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was an incredibly intense time. How do you understand the blocking out part? What's going on there, do you think?
I think it's just a way of getting through it without having to re-experience all the intensity that was reigning during that period. It was such a short period of life, but it was so intense. And I guess it's like maybe comparable to like boot camp, you know, because we would call it singer's boot camp. I feel like we were grinded down with our confidence because it makes you moldable. It makes you easy to just be told what to do. And I already was kind of grinded down by my relationship with my dad. And, you know, that added with just my interpretation of my religious experience. And then the producers and the showrunners of the show. And I, you know, later talked to other contestants and they were still affected by that time, even though like 6, 7, 8 years had passed, or even like a decade for some of the people I was talking to. And I was like, wait, you guys experienced this too? I thought it was just me. And they're like, oh, And they're like, and we're like, why are we still letting that time period affect us? Like, to a point of like paranoia. Mm-hmm. Like, we were afraid of people having our number, knowing who we were, and noticing that other artists, it was like, oh, well, that's how everyone is. And one of my friends, Melinda Doolittle, was hanging out with some of her other friends, like Amy Grant and Vince Gill, and they were more famous than we were, you know, the longer careers and more hits, but they did not have the same paranoia that we had all shared and instilled in us. We all came from different parts of the country, different backgrounds, different families, different faiths, beliefs, but we all had the same shared trauma. Well, like the same paranoia that we can't let people into our lives and we can't trust people. And it was kind of like a wake up moment for us. Like, why do we all share this experience? Why do we all have such a harder time to trust people than even some of our other celebrity and singer and artist peers? It is. And we're trying to make sense of it. And
have you?
Melinda had gone to, and I had originally had all this in the book as well, but I had, you know, had to take out some things, a lot of things. Melinda was like, there's someone here. Like, we all lived in Nashville at the time. And she's like, well, I've been meeting with someone who specializes with reality TV show contestants. She said, because he's identified that a lot of reality TV contestants share the same experience of paranoia. And I guess like letting people and letting TV producers into your world and being able to manipulate your world and how it's perceived to an audience and to the TV viewers. And you don't have any control over that. And the way that they can continue taking advantage of your real persona is by grinding you down, making you not trust anybody but them. And at the same time, they're the very people that you shouldn't be trusting. Mm. Because there's like, hey, great, now we can use you however we want. Because you trust us. You will open up to us about personal things, which we can use in our program and in our TV, and exploit that. And you're not playing a character. You are yourself. But at the same time, you have to play a character because we want you to be a certain way for our TV show. In a way, it was just like another addition to how my dad, what I was doing with my dad. I was being whatever my dad wanted me to be. And I think I just got really good at that because I was like, you know, I'll be whatever my church leaders want me to be. I'll be whatever my dad wants me to be. I'll be whatever the producers want me to be. And the producers liked me. They wanted me to be the all-American boy next door. But at the same time, I was afraid because I was like, I don't know how to be that. Because I was the kid who hid. I hid from everybody, but I had to be like this happy, energetic, I'm so glad to be here, starry-eyed boy, even though that's not quite what I was.
Let's talk about your commitment to the church as you embark on a musical career after Idol. One of the things you write about was the sort of the strategies that you put in place to keep yourself clean on tour. Go to church, never swear. And you say you pushed all sexual feelings deep down. You said you locked them away, and this is how you put it, into an inner dungeon. Mm-hmm. You doubled down, basically. We talk about this part. You were determined to be a good Mormon boy.
Yeah, I mean, I just tried to apply everything that I was told was the right thing to do. You know, keep the commandments. And how to, as my people in my church would say, you know, like hold on to the iron rod and it will safely guide us through the mist of darkness and the temptations of the world. And the more obedient you were in following with those commandments and rules, the better you would be protected from the world. It was made very clear to me that the industry I was getting into was a very dangerous one, at least from my faith community. You know, they were all like, this is a very dangerous place you're going to, and you've got to protect yourself. And I think my dad also believed that. Like, we were all taught that the entertainment industry is the scary, progressive, liberal, free to do whatever sinful acts you want there. To an extent, I guess they were right in ways. In other ways, they weren't. I feel like a lot of of it was felt very much taboo. Kind of felt like when I was on my mission in Chile, because I was a missionary, Mormon missionary for 2 years after my career. And there'd be like taboo things where it's like, no, don't go outside after drinking something hot. You'll get boca chueca, which would be, oh, your mouth will get crooked and stay that way. And everyone just believed it. I'm like, oh, that doesn't exist where I'm from. They're like, no. I swear, like my cousin, he knows this guy who's his neighbor who has it. And that's how it felt for me with the entertainment industry. It's like, okay, like everyone's like, you've got to be careful. So you better hold extra tight to the iron rod.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
Well, it also brings up this, you're really religious. You started talking to a therapist that you found through this Mormon app. And this is when you learned about this idea of scrupulosity. Mm-hmm. Which we've actually talked about on this show. Oh. And it was something that this therapist suggested, David, you have this. It's a basically obsessive compulsive disorder related to your faith belief. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you write in the book that you needed structure and direction and it wasn't coming from your father, so you needed to get it from somewhere else. And so I guess this is what was going on. Is that how you understand it?
Well, yeah, I felt like I was so used to this like totalitarian approach that my dad had with running my life.
Yeah.
Once I was like, okay, I can't have my dad in the picture anymore. And he wasn't. I felt empty without it. It was like my drug. I needed it to feel complete. So I was like, who's going to fill this hole for me? And so I found it in like one of my band members, for example, which then transitioned because this band member was also very, very religious, very, very much heeded to all the commandments and reading their scriptures every day and going to church every Sunday, even when we were traveling on tour, which is something I wasn't even doing. Huh. It was very appealing to me. And I was like, I want that. This is the kind of like all-encompassing thing that I need to take over my life because I'm missing that. I felt like I had developed an unhealthy attachment style and with my dad, and I needed something else to fill that void, to be unhealthily attached to,
yeah,
and extremely codependent on. And so I felt like this band member was that new filler for me. I was pretty obedient already. I was a good Mormon boy, but this helped me to become fanatical. To where it became my everything. And who cares about what's going on with my career? Like, I didn't care anymore. I was just like, when is the next time we can go see a church history site? When's the next time I could do a fireside? And the next time I could go visit people? And it was euphoric, really. It was a euphoric feeling, and I loved how it felt. And I felt like that euphoria was God. And it's kind of interesting to look back on that now, because I don't look at it the same way.
Yeah.
It's like the radicalization of it all helped me to get to that euphoric state, which then led me to make the decision to go on my mission as well. I was still hungry to get the approval of my band member and very much get the approval of all church members that were around me in my church. And all throughout the world, I was just like, I craved to see someone say, yes, like you're doing the right thing. You're doing God's work. And every time I heard that, it was like another hit. Eventually, like after I got back from my mission, and the church had one of these apps called the Mormon Channel.
Yeah.
That's what it was called. Once this new prophet came in, they turned it into the Saints Channel.
Yeah.
But at the time it was the Mormon Channel, and there was a therapist that was speaking. And I was like, you know, I feel like I could really use therapy, but I've been given a warning to take heed to make sure that I didn't meet with therapists who mingle too much of the world with God's doctrine and morphed it into something that would stray you away from the truth that God, because, you know, science could be deceptive is what I was learning. So I was like, oh, this is a therapist who's a Mormon on the Mormon Channel. So
this is legit.
This is legit, and yeah, it's safe. I can talk to them. But you know, ironically enough, it was that therapist, that Mormon therapist on the Mormon Channel, who said, as we were talking, because I was like, I need to be fixed because my relationships aren't working. So what do we need to do to fix me so that I can make marriage work?
Because what does that mean? That I'm attracted to men.
Yeah, I don't think I disclosed that to the therapist.
I don't think you did.
But I was just like, there's some trauma that I need to fix and heal so that I can be there fully present for my future spouse.
Okay, so let's talk about, there are these two moments that I think are really interesting that you write about in the book. One is when you're on your mission and you're having this argument with a companion who was always late. And so, of course, you're the good companion who's always obedient. And you're like, you're not following the rules. God is all about obedience. And you were taking him to task. But it's around this time, in this debate, you break down in tears.
Mm-hmm.
Tell the story.
Yeah, I was really getting at him because I was like, we are missionaries. We've dedicated our lives fully to God and to be obedient and to follow him with exactness. That's what we had been taught. That was like one of the themes in our missions was to be obedient with exactness. So I was like, you can't let any little thing flub up. You can't let the time go by because any form of disobedience shows that you don't really care what God thinks and you don't care about following him and being one with him. And so I was like, you must be obedient. Arriving on time, leaving at time, because obedience is important. That's what we're supposed to do as missionaries. And I just broke down because I was like, I'm not being obedient. Because no matter how obedient I try to be with the schedule and the rules and the teaching and the studying, I'm not being obedient with my feelings. I wasn't trying to be disobedient with my feelings. They were just there. But for me, that was clearly revealing that I was not obedient and fully consecrated in my heart to following God because something inside me was constantly leading me astray. Even though I was not acting on those feelings, I wasn't fantasizing, I wasn't wanting them, I wasn't dwelling on them, they were just there. Yeah. Homosexuality was always paired. It was never singled out even like as for why it was so bad. It was just like homosexuality is the same as murder. It's the same as pedophilia. And so you just kind of assumed, well, I'm basically a murderer. I'm basically a pedophile because that's what people say I am for being a homosexual. And you try to think, well, what is evil about loving someone of the same sex? And I think it was always kind of deflected by saying, well, it's because you're a pervert and you are basically committing murder. Yeah. And so that's how you correlate those feelings. And even though you don't experience this desire to kill people or you don't have a desire to commit pedophilia, you're basically still believing that you are in that same category. Mm. And so you just think you're the worst thing in the world because you're unnatural. So I was like, there's something unnatural about me and I'm clearly not doing enough to keep my feelings tamed. So that's why I broke down because I was just like, I don't know what else to do. I don't know. I'm doing everything I can. I was as scrupulous as you could be.
Yeah.
I was scrupulous. I was obsessed. And I think a lot of queer people who haven't come to terms yet with their sexuality become scrupulous.
David Archuleta. We're talking about his new memoir. It's called Devout, Losing My Faith to Find Myself. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking to the singer-songwriter David Archuleta today about his new memoir. In it, he traces his story from a sheltered Mormon kid to international fame, writes about a domineering father and a religious culture that also controlled his life. He goes on an LDS mission. He becomes a poster boy for the faith. But in the end, he comes out. He ends up leaving the church. And he develops a very different concept of God and his place in the world. The book is called Devout.
You tell the story about how you dated women. You got engaged a few times, actually. You write about these relationships in the book. And you tell the story about how a few days after you had broken up with a woman, you had what you described as a revelation. Set this up for us, though, if you would. You're in your living room alone, and you say you felt something while you were walking across your shaggy Walmart rug. It was a lightning slash of a sensation, you say. Would you tell us about this moment?
Yeah. It was a time period where I was just consistently spiraling down.
Yeah.
And it was levels. Like, I thought, you know, I'll get through this. You know, it's just my trial of faith. But it just got to a point where I just felt nothing. So it went to this point of desperation, but also kind of just like accepting the fate of I'm hopeless and that's okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter anymore because I've accepted my fate that I will never be good enough. And you get there because you think this evil in me is going to consume me because no matter what I do, I cannot get rid of my feelings of being attracted to men. And that makes me a horrible, perverted being. And the devil must have a hold of my soul, is what you're convinced. And it was what I was convinced. I've learned that a lot of other people get to that point and are convinced of the same thing. Interestingly enough, it's like a cycle. It's a pattern. But I hit that low point and I just accept my fate. And, you know, there's a point where I just think, you know, what's the better option, to take my life or to let this consume me? And I may just end up becoming gay eventually, because I cannot hold this down anymore. And so I was like, well, before that happens, maybe I should just take my life. Because you kind of weigh out, okay, what's a worse sin? What's a more unpardonable sin, to be a homosexual or to take your own life? Because they were both considered bad. But I'm like, okay, what's worse though? And I just come to the conclusion that there's a better option for my eternal salvation, that I may still be able to save my soul if I take my life early, than if I became gay. So you just come to peace with that decision, and you just kind of let go of everything, and you start just kind of saying, okay, how do I do this so I don't hurt my family? And I was like, well, you know, they'll be able to have whatever savings I have. They can take my life insurance. I was just like, I was just thinking of all the reasons why they would still be okay, and that would be better than if I stuck around as a sinful being. So, and as the worst of human, which is so weird to me looking back, that it's like, it's so odd to me that so many people of faith consider someone being gay worse than so many other things. I mean, there's so many, they have so much more grace for even child abusers who've abused their power in church leadership positions. And for some reason, they find more grace for those people than they do for someone who happens to fall in love with someone of the same sex and does not have, you know, no impact on someone else's life, other than they feel like it's unnatural. And it's, you know, you should challenge yourself on the it's unnatural narrative. Yeah. But anyway, I had not gotten to that point yet. So I was really depressed. I would try to, you know, still live my life, but you just get to a point where silently, you know, where you lose hopelessness inside, even though you're trying to express yourself outwardly, like things are fine.
You're kind of numb.
Yeah, you're numb. But you just kind of go on autopilot. But I finally, you know, there's this moment where I feel this, a release, this break from that numbness, and you finally feel something. And for me, just feeling anything, I'm like, that's God. That's God. And I immediately dropped down on my knees and I was like, God, if you're there, please, if you really have a plan for me, and if there's a future for me, please just change me, because I'm just tired. I'm exhausted. I don't know what else to do. And like, I've done everything I know how. And that's where I just felt this feeling of God say, David, you need to stop asking me this, because you've been asking this since you were 12 years old. You're 30 years old now. You probably see by this point, I'm not going to change this about you, because there's no reason to. And that went so against everything I'd been taught, everything I believed, and every religion that I knew, that I'd gone to, at least. I was like, that's not God. Because that's not what I was taught God thinks of this. And there I was in this feeling that was the most godly feeling I'd ever felt. You know, just say, it's time for you to see you the way I see you. Because I don't see you how you see yourself. And I don't see you how a lot of well-meaning people who try to follow me, and they mean well, they don't see you how I see you. So that was very difficult for me to accept. I mean, to make a long story, you know, at least somewhat short, you know, it's God was like, if you think this is a mistake, then give yourself the grace to make mistakes. And you will learn that it isn't. And then you'll finally see how I do. And hopefully you'll help other people see it the way I do, because a lot of people are not seeing it the way I want them to. And I mean, it was like when I was willing to go against the mold, at least the Mormon mold, you know, and even like just the religious mold in the whole, because it's like Muslims, Christians as a whole looked at it as they're in like unison with their agreement. And yet I was like, this almighty feeling, like this divine, is telling me that I'm fine the way I am. So it was a huge moment. And that's when I decided, okay, even if it's a mistake, I can have that peace of mind that I can make mistakes and I can learn from them. And if this is a mistake, I can always repent and come back. And, but at least I'll know. And yeah.
Let me ask you finally, in a song you include in the audiobook for Devout, there's a song called Old and Young. And you say, I'm old and I'm young at the same time. And I wanted you to explain what you mean by that, because in the lyrics, you say, I'm still finding out what it feels like to be falling in love, feeling good enough. And then you say this, sing this, I'm starting to understand I'm human. That seems important, that idea. Would you say something about that finally?
Yeah. I thought that, I guess I've held this false belief that being queer in any form was subhuman. Like it was a second class species in a way. And holding that belief, I just believed I was less than everybody. I wasn't worthy. I wasn't even worthy to live if I couldn't get rid of that. And I felt like I had to hold up this image for everybody too, that I had to be an example. I was the one that people needed to follow by being obedient and having to always hold this certain front. Not that I was feeling like I was two-faced. I tried to hold this front and live up to that front, but I just never felt like I could because of what I held inside me and that I could never be honest about, because like people didn't want me to be honest about it, you know, when I tried to with some of my church leaders. So to finally accept myself, even if that meant being broken and being imperfect,
that's part of the human experience. And to allow myself to fall in love in the way that I was always told was wrong. And to do it anyway is when I finally allowed myself to feel like I was alive, that I was living, that I was human.
David Archuleta, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
David Archuleta. His memoir is called Devout, Losing My Faith to Find Myself. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. And you can email us if you like at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.